Heck yeah, you better learn that dang old semantic CSS and semantic HTML and raw JavaScript before you move on to anything at all more complicated than that.
Hey, Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave, NPR Rupert, and with me is Chris, Fresh Air, Coyer. Chris, how are you today?
I'm doing particular. I don't have a personality picked out.
I'm sorry.
That was a good one, though. You went with the soft one, you know?
You just soft. Soft jazz voice. Mm-hmm. I'm my soft jazz voice. Chris, speaking of soft jazz voices.
We're going to do some soft question and answer this week. We have guests next week, but not this week.
We have guests next week, but this is going to be just a bunch of softball questions. No, Shop Talking. This is hardball all the time. Question number one. Chris, let's get into it, and we'll just wrap up early if it's okay. You know, we'll hit that 45-minute mark but Alex Moraro writes in. Yeah. I'm 39. Been doing front end since about
I'm 38. Hey,
I'm 37, 38 this month. Hey. All right. I'm doing front end in about 6 years. I really like it a lot because I learn something every day, and I get to build cool stuff. I like that attitude. However, shoes drop.
However,
we need like a big like dubstep drop whenever somebody says "however" in a question. It's like "however." I've been thinking lately: is there an age limit for this profession? Should I start looking into other directions, project management, UX, maybe? What do you think? Do you see yourselves doing this job at 50?
Oh yeah, 40 is the limit for front end for sure. I'd say, you know, as soon as you get 40, you can't type angle brackets anymore.
Wait, that's sarcasm. That's sarcasm on the internet. I often do think like, what am I going to do after this? Even recently, I was like, what am I going to do next? And I was like, maybe I should like write a resume, crack my knuckles, skills, websites. That was it. That was all. I was like, other skills.
That's not true at all. Cough. I think very highly of my skill set. I think I'm good at websites, but I'm good at communication and I'm good at communicating ideas, and I'm good at ideation, and I'm good at like UX-y thinking about what people need out of something. And I think those are transferable skills to something else. Like if I wanted to make a product, I think I could do all the resource gathering and research and figuring it out, and my web skills would be useful too, but it wouldn't be the whole thing. And I'd know how to at least be somewhat of a leader, and I could hire people and just. And you could too. And I think we have a lifetime of skills that we've acquired tangentially through websites.
Yeah. You know, this is me. I hope there is a wave of something called like a technical project manager. And that's only just to say like projects where my project manager has technical fluency, like in the product, understands how the bits and bobbles go together and to make the site, and they speak that fluently. Those projects are usually a lot more successful, or even the conversations go a lot further because you actually know, like it's like, oh, we can't do this because the database that, you know, is set to a varchar 255. And what you're asking for is like a text, you know, field, and that's, you know, that's going to be a big migration. You know, like you say that to somebody who like went to business school and they're just like, good, so when's it done, you know? And you're like, but that's a thing, like we have to like talk to this other department. Jeff's the only one who can run migration, so we have to go talk to Jeff, and he works in a different department, so we'll have to get budget to like contract gen, you know, like, and so like to have like a technical project manager who understands like, oh, it's a VAR car and it needs to be like a text. Great. Let me get on that. Like I can go talk to that team and discuss it with them. They don't need you as a liaison, right? Like, so you don't have to go with project manager to go talk to Jeff. I think that is just a money saver for her company. I think that's a huge boost to everybody's morale, like any kind of developer to developer conversation or like kind of like, I guess, cross organizational or cross team kind of communication. I think that role of like a technical project manager is kind of huge. And I think like in my mind, like, I think that's going to be a huge thing. And maybe that's like the future for us old dogs is kind of cycling into those roles. You know, cause I think we've all been on like in situations where, and I'm not, everyone has a role in a company. I don't want to dismiss anyone's job, whatsoever, but you know, for like when you're talking about digital products and technical products, like it very much helps to have somebody who understands that medium. The conversations just happen faster and go farther and deeper, and you kind of solve the problems a lot quicker, in my humble opinion.
Yep.
So maybe that's a direction you can look. I mean, I don't know.
I want to look that direction. I write tons of code every day. And that's fine, mm-hmm. and it keeps me up to date. And I'm definitely not in that category of being like, don't make me a manager. Don't take my precious code away from me. This is what I was born and loved to do. If I was promoted to manager, I would be dealing with people instead of code, and everything would be awful then. And that's not what I want out of life. I'm like, oh my God, make me the. When do I get the manager promotion? Looking for that manager promotion any day. I'd like to have that baby because I'd like to love to have enough people, quote unquote, under me that are doing more of the code stuff. Not because I'm unable to do it, because I'm looking for a career transition in a way, and it's my own business. So this is a little tongue in cheek or whatever, because it's on me to get to the point where that can happen. But yes, I'm looking to grow. I'm looking for that to happen because not because I'm scared of writing code, but because I've just been doing it long enough that I want and I think that my skill set can transition into a different role. That's all.
Yeah. No, I think that's, you know, that's the thing. I think there's, I met a guy, 40s-ish, was working at a company and, you know, he was up for like a promotion and he just was like, please don't give it to me. I want to code, actually, not just do one-on-ones every day. So, you know,
yeah,
I thought that was very cool.
That's more common, and I think that's great. Yeah, you should be aware of that in yourself. If you don't want a people job, you don't want to be a manager.
Yeah, yeah. Like, don't get into that world. You know, Laura Hogan.
Master of all this talk. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, probably like just stop listening to this show and go read her blog. But she is very like very transitioned into this role of kind of now a people manager, less of a code wrangler. And so that's, you know, that's cool. And it's been cool to see that transition. I mean, we had her on X number of years ago talking about kind of design code stuff and it was more code design.
If you love thinking about this stuff too, look up Jennifer Derry and bplucky.com who's similar and talks about the, you know, manager training and so now you're a manager and this exact topic she's very informed on and speaks about eloquently.
That's cool. Yeah. No, I mean I don't know. I personally see myself coding at 50. I don't know what I'll be coding, actually. You know, I think we talked about WebAssembly in the last episode just a smidge, and now my whole brain's just like, is that what I'm going to be doing, like, in 10 years? I don't know. And then I'm like, or like Houdini, obviously. We talked about a couple episodes ago. I'm like, oh, man, is that what I'm going to be doing, like, just writing Houdini scripts? I wonder what I will be doing. In 10 years. So yeah, who knows? I assume at some point it makes sense to cycle out, not to say, I don't know, just because there is like so much churn in, you know, frameworks and language and all that stuff, that maybe it is, you know, maybe you do leave that up to the kids to some degree so they can kind of build cool stuff. But, you know, that value of being senior, I guess, is very huge, you know, that you don't make silly decisions or repeat mistakes. So you have some experience there.
All right. We managed to go deep into that. Good luck, Alex. You know, recap, the most important thing I would express to you is that I don't think that your brain has fundamental differences in it as you approach 50 years old or older that makes you not able to do anything.
Yeah, I don't think it stops you, right? No. Right?
Absolutely not.
It doesn't. Your brain doesn't get hard. The fluid in your ears does get you hard, and that makes you more, the interstitial fluid in your ears gets hardened, and that makes you're unable to ride on roller coasters as you get older. But your brain does not get hard,
okay,
to my knowledge.
Jorn Zander writes in, my question is about correct body copy from clients. On a recent project, the clients gave me big chunks of ever-changing body copy with lots of technical terms and special language. Turned out to be flawed with lots of typos, incorrect use of commas, and so on. I tried to correct them as good as I could, but not good enough. The website is live now, and the typos keep coming in because now the clients suddenly care. The site is live, I guess. I'd like to argue that dealing with code and getting a design to work is what I'm supposed to do, but it feels like I did a sloppy job. Of course, there's, you know, spell checkers, but that's a little bit limited. It doesn't correct wrong words that are spelled right. Also, German is a very complicated language with very laborious grammar rules. Of course, there's services out there which offer copy editing, but the clients of a Joe Schmall, is Joe Schmall the German version of Joe Schmo? Web designer that doesn't like to pay for such an additional service. Now I wonder if you've had issues like that, like at Paravel, for example. Wow, you know? It's their copy, but you think it reflects badly upon you because you're the web's creator in this case. I would wash my hands of that as soon as possible. Be like, it's your crappy copy. It ain't my fault.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like a few strategies. Long hair, don't care. pay me to fix your mistakes.
Yeah.
I will try to get the best thing. Or I'll kind of primp it for you, but I'm not going to spend my whole, I got other things to worry about. So I'm not going to spend.
Those are three options. Those are all good. I would communicate at least the problem and be like, look at this copy is maybe once go through it with a red pen, circle all the graph and be like, look at how bad your copy is. You know, I just want to make you aware of it. You don't pay me to fix your copy, so I'm not going to, but you should be aware of it.
I'm lucky to work with Reagan. Reagan catches a lot of these things and like, grammar and nice. He reads a lot. That's a big deal too. Like you need somebody who has understanding of the language, the German or English, you know, somebody who like has looked at a lot of words and know what they should look like. I think that's like a very big thing. Cause Reagan will catch things like, you know, like what's your go-to, you know, that's actually go-to, like go-to, like that's how the MLS like prescribes that. So it's not just like some weird camel cased word or whatever. So like you have like, you know, we'll fix things like that or make recommendations. And in some ways, Reagan has become kind of a micro copy kind of expert. Like you kind of, I think that's part of design. Like, you know, your clients, there's two types of clients in the world. Here we go. Binaries always work. There's two types of clients in the world. Those who like prepare too much, you know, like they give you like 7,000 words to put on the webpage and they say every single word is very important. They all have to go on the website and you're like, I don't know what to do. And then there's the other client who like will only respond to something once it's live and on the website. Like the second.
Yeah, right. That liveness of it makes it a big deal. I totally have heard people like that. or the opposite way where something's live and you're like, I have to pull this. Then they're like, what? And then they,
what?
Yeah. Then they get.
Yeah. No, there's no way they can even consider the spelling until it is up on the internet. Yeah. And I actually probably fall into this. I push blog posts and then I'll tweet about it. And then I'll just,
then you like, fix the typos. Totally.
Then I fix the typos. I'm like hot fixing, like while people are like coming to my website all the time, 100% of the time. So like, and I get, you know, tweets, DMs. DMs are always the best. DMs about typos.
Oh,
and,
I love that. I got one today. Thank you. Really? Thank you.
I actually, when it comes in, I go, ah, guy. But secretly, I'm like, I correct that default posturing and I say thank you. Because it is, you write 1,000 words. What are the odds you're going to get all 1,000?
I'm a huge fan of Grammarly, by the way. Grammarly does an awesome job, I think. I don't know if it works in German, but that has doubled my, or halved my mistakes, probably.
Yeah, I use in code, VS Code, I use, there's two plugins, like a spell checker plugin.
Oh, that's nice.
And
smart where it has to like not check HTML elements, but what does within a p tag or whatever.
I don't know if it's smart, but yeah, it's pretty good. And I think you can configure it to like only work on, only work on markdown files or something like that. If you keep your content in there, something like that. But then another one I use is called WriteGood. WriteGood Linter. And WriteGood is like a set of rules. And then the linter basically it's like a JavaScript linter, and it goes through your code and it's like, does squigglies if you have grammar errors, if you're using passive voice, or if you're using, just redundant words or something like that. It'll kind of go through. It's not as powerful as Grammarly. It's probably like a very like, Grammarly is like a pay money for us thing. But this is kind of, I don't know, money. It gets me there.
I think I did like I like Grammarly on Twitter and they have some share it for free Grammarly thing. If you get 10 users and then I got way more than that and now I don't pay for it.
Oh, pyramids. Nice. I wish I was in that pyramid. I'll have to get in that pyramid. But no, it's a cool, I like the service. I like the idea. I really do wish I could like, I wish I knew somebody like a copy editor basically who could like preview like websites or blog posts or something like that. And just say like, could you like just skim this and give me feedback? And I guess I could do that with my coworkers. That would be such a cool service, like for $50, I'll look over your blog post, or $100, I'll look over 5 pages of your website or something like that and mark it up. Like, wouldn't that be cool? That'd be so cool. It'd be worth the money. So I guess, did we have an answer? I guess it just,
I would say do your options,
Bjorn, but also feel free to charge for their mistakes.
It's clearly bugging you because if you were option number one, long hair, don't care, you wouldn't have written into a podcast. So you care already. So the fact that you care means that you got to at least express your caring.
Yeah. 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 You just have to kind of be like, hey, one other service I offer is copy editing. I'd like to help you with a little bit, some of these words, something like that. All right. Next question. Martin Coopins, I recently made a SCSS mixin called RFS, which automatically calculates the font size based on the browser screen width. For more information, can be found here, and it's like a responsive font sizing. What's your opinion on this?
RFS is responsive font sizing.
Yeah. Is this kind of the automated that kind of where you do the calc stuff? All that.
Yeah,
all
that. It was confusing to me at first because he says, I made an SCSS mixin, which calculates the font size based on the browser screen width. So right away, I'm like, it doesn't matter that it's SCSS in a way. Like SCSS doesn't know what the browser screen width is. There's nothing about the technology of SCSS that can know that, So it's already but there's more to it than that, Like, yes, it does uses calc and viewport units together to calculate it. So it's not SCSS required. It's just SCSS in this case to abstract that idea a little bit so that you can just call this mix in with a number and you don't have to look at the viewport units and the calc and the media query and that stuff. You just say include RFS and it abstracts the complicated looking stuff away from you, which is cool, I think, because there's a lot of different ways to tackle this. In fact, just last week, I saw someone stumble across this idea and they tweeted it and it got a bunch of traction from people I was surprised that hadn't heard of it in a way, I guess. Not that, I don't know, that sounds like pretentious or something, but I was like, they put a very basic calc equation together that incorporated viewport units. This is like, look, has anybody ever heard of this? I'm like, I have, because it was like, it's been like dissected and thought about and talked about six ways to Sunday in a way, and it's very complicated, actually, because if you just use, like, if you just, for example, you just set your font size and viewport units, it's too extreme how much they grow and shrink. So then one of people's thoughts is like, okay, well, through some media queries and some dancing around, at least I could set minimums and maximums. That way it scales with the viewport size, but it never gets too small and it never gets too big. Mm-hmm. And then there's another way. It's like, well, maybe one of the ways I can approach it not getting too small or too big is to just sprinkle in, this is the calc part, just sprinkle in a little bit of viewport units along with a fixed size, like M's, REM's, or pixels or something. That way, it's, and then like the more complicated way is let's do that and have a lock at the front and a lock at the back for how much this gets. So you can get as complicated as you want to get here. No locks, a little locks, extreme, a little extreme. There's a million ways you can slice and dice this thing. Well, not a million, but there's a number of ways you can slice and dice this thing to get what you want out of it. And it looks like this particular plugin, which is cool, slices it in a way that it doesn't give you a heck of a lot of choices. It gives you a max. And it uses a pretty heavy sprinkling of viewport width units to handle this. So it's making some choices for you that maybe you like that. Maybe you're just like, I don't want to think about this. I just want to use it and those defaults work for me. I find that it's too nuanced to use an abstraction. I want to see it right in my CSS. I want to decide about the locks. You know, I want to decide how much viewport sprinkling goes in there. I need all the control I can get here because I'm probably not going to, unfortunately, I hate to say, I'm not going to like your defaults. I'm going to like my defaults. And I want to see it operating. It does have more control than I thought it did, for the record. It lets you set a bunch of.
Yeah, it's got like four or five options to configure. I think this is great for like when you know you want the effect, but like you don't really want to expend the brain power to like do all of the effect. You know what I mean? Yeah. I've done that plenty of times. Like I just did like a what was it? SVG stroke dash offset or whatever, stroke dash dash offset. just like an animation. And I just was, normally I would have just like used a plugin and just like, whatever, the plugin does it for me and wonderful. And that's actually a really great way to do it. But like, so I think this is great in that regard, like kind of a special language to kind of do this responsive font sizing, because it is not intuitive. It is kind of gross. Like you just kind of chuck numbers at a machine and kind of hope it works out, in my experience. I have a very bad version of it on like my titles, I think, on my website. So I could definitely benefit from it. That said, I probably like you, Chris, but this is my whole deal is kind of moving towards just vanilla CSS. I would probably just like code it in there and try to write a comment and explain it to myself. However, I think this is cool.
Yeah, using an abstraction sometimes is just as complicated as not. I mean, it's a whole dependency here with five different variables that you set, and it seems just as complicated as just doing it yourself. That's not a judgment. You're like, if you people should know about this, we'll link it in the show notes. If you like having this level of abstraction, rock and roll.
But you know what's cool is Martin, who wrote in, has a PR on Bootstrap to get this into Bootstrap. So like you,
oh, neat.
And I think that's actually a perfect place for it, just because like
yeah,
like you want, like with Bootstrap or kind of, you just kind of want to like plop some numbers in and get your design, your type system.
Like
you
this
know?
Kind of thinking so. That it's kind of a more advanced or evolution of responsive design in a way that's not just like make these hard settings of things like margins and paddings and font sizes and stuff, but instead set them upon a gradation so that at any given point, you know, it's not like 10 pixels is the perfect number of pixels for this 372 pixel wide screen. It's like, no, I've set, you know, like I've almost set it like a exotic percentage, and that those things scale and shrink as the sizes do. And I think that's kind of a neat way to think about design. Other people, you know, we should shout out to Tim Brown, who's done lots of thinking about this, these locks, CSS locks kind of things, and Mike Reith Mueller, who's done a lot of this kind of pioneering work in calc and font size and line height and stuff. That it's worth looking at those demos for sure. There's probably about 10 posts on CSS tricks as we were sorting it out for ourselves and linking to stuff and thinking about it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot. It's a fascinating approach. One of the things that I like about it is that at its simplest, it's kind of a one-liner that you can extract a lot of value out of. And I love those. I like a good CSS trick that gives you something, a neat effect, but isn't hard to wrap your mind around. It's really literally a one-liner.
Mm-hmm. I like one-liners. That would be a good CSS tricks post, Chris. Favorite one-liners?
Yeah, yeah.
Favorite one-liners.
Explain none.
It's good. It's good. Hey, what's up with min-max in CSS? Oh, isn't that kind of coming, too? Like, isn't that?
Yeah, I feel like there's traction for a minute there, and maybe it went away, or maybe I'm just not as aware of it. But yeah, min-max came to grid, so we have it there. And then, but it was always talked about as, you know, wouldn't that be nice to use anywhere as padding, as font size, as et cetera, you know?
Yeah.
But how do you, like, when you set it as a font size, how does it decide to be in the middle of those two things? Mm-hmm. Like, is it just shorthand for setting? I mean, what we really need is min font size and max font size. That way you can set a calc equation, but min will override it. You know, for example, mm-hmm. like width, you can say width 20%, but min width is still 300 pixels or whatever. So it will do the calculation for width, but the min width actually wins. So mm-hmm. this way, if you had min font size and max font size, you could set a calc with your font size, but also set a min font size, and that way the min would win. So if the calculation gets too small, then you have these locks that aren't complicated. They don't need media query blockers and all this complicated stuff we have to do now. And then maybe min-max is just a shorthand for min font size and max font size, which would be nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought there was like min-max kind of on everything was kind of in the like in the CSS working group kind of talk, you know? I don't know if that's going to happen though. Like, kind of making min max available everywhere, but I don't know if that's actually going to.
You almost want like min is max or min do max, so you can pass it three parameters, like the minimum, what it should be in between those, and maximum. Yeah.
Here's the minimum. Here's the maximum, and then here's what the algorithm or the math
right.
unit I want you to do it with. I was just reading around issues kind of related to this RFS thing, which again I think is pretty cool. But viewport size typography. A lot of accessibility people were kind of ringing alarm bells about how that can be bad for accessibility. So careful out there. I don't know much about it. So I would like to know more.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Netlify. Netlify is web hosting, but with a twist. It's really powerful, interesting web hosting. Static web hosting is one way to think of it, but I think their messaging is important here. It's static without limits, which is, you know, and if you're interested in this and really digging into it, go back a couple episodes and listen to the episode of Shop Talk with Phil Hawksworth, where we talk about the Jamstack and static hosting and serverless and all that stuff. We go deep dive into this, and it's just fascinating. But, you know, if you're just like, what does Netlify do? Like, why should I use a static host? Well, some of it is just so great. One of them is they have a CLI, so you can just be like, oh, you have a folder full of a project that you're working on just, you know, locally, and you're running your build commands and all that stuff. You can just be like, I'm just going to deploy it to Netlify from the command line, and goes out to your Netlify account and deploys the website, and you're done. It's just kind of amazing that way. Or even more common, possibly, or what appeals to me anyway, is that you can attach a Netlify account to a Git repo. So anytime I push to my repo, which I want anyway, right, because version control is important and all that, gives all the features that something like GitLab or GitHub brings, that just deploys then. Or I cut a branch and I push that up to my repo, Netlify sees that and deploys that as well, like a staging environment. And gives me a URL for that I can check out. And now I have like my main master deployed branch, and I have a sub branch that I'm like testing out, so I can check that out, like staging. But I can also treat that as like, hey, maybe I'll split traffic 50-50 those and do like server-side A-B testing. How cool is that? Okay, so it's static hosting. How am I going to process my forms? Netlify does that for you. Just throw the Netlify attribute on the form. Netlify will see it and handle form processing for you. Just a few of the excellent features of Netlify. It's so cool. I can't speak highly of them enough. Go check out Netlify. Thanks for your sponsorship.
All right. Next question. Anderson Dougals writes in. When and why are you to use Yarn over NPM? Is it okay to use both? Oof. I don't know that I'd use both. Although you do have to use...
You can. Like, they both end up putting a bunch of crap in a node_modules folder. And I think it largely does the same thing in a way. Yarn, when it came out, had some very distinct advantages over NPM. And one, it was really fast. And two, it had a lock file, which was a really super big deal. And I'm glad that that exists now. But now NPM has upgraded to the point where it has lock files too. And so that would be weird to have two different lock files. That's definitely a weird thing. But if you have them both installed and you used one or the other randomly on a project, I think the result is largely the same, isn't it? Just put some stuff in a node modules folder. Yeah. I think they're compatible-ish.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess they wouldn't fight each other, because, yeah, it's just a bundle of node module folders. I think people like the Yarn syntax. I think it's just a little bit more intuitive or something. But
you know, I have a weird question about this. I wonder if you've come across that's tangential to this. Mm-hmm. But one of them is like, let's say React 15.7.8 drops or something.
Love it.
Yeah. There's a bunch of dependencies of React. It's not all by itself. It mm-hmm. exists in the NPM universe and has dependencies of its own, like mm-hmm. left pad or whatever. I don't know exactly what they all are, but I'm sure there's at least some, if not a lot. Okay, all those packages have their own dependencies. Like, and mm-hmm. in I think it uses, like use this version or greater of some of them. You know, they're not all locked, the dependencies of it. So you pull React and you build it, and you get a, you know, React 16.7.2.min.js. But I pull it like 3 days later, and it's the same version. React hasn't updated. But because there's 100 sub-packages, some of those have updated. That straight up means that my version of that exact version number of React is different than yours, mm-hmm. which is a little bit weird to me. But that's what lock files kind of solve, in that if I build it again, if another developer pulls the project, they're going to pull my package.json file and my Yarn lock file, so that the version between us developers on this project, at least that's the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of the big deal, so that between developers on an exact project, our builds will be the same. So that's good. At least we don't have inexplicably bizarre problems that way. But it doesn't solve it like industry-wide in a way. And that, like, yeah. My version might be a little different than your version on a different project with the same version number. Or does it just not matter?
I mean, if it's a micro version, it doesn't matter, you know. But if it's like a big semvar, you know, the first digit, you know, that does matter. Like because that's an officially breaking change or whatever. If you commit your lock file, gemfile.lock, package.lock, yarn.lock or whatever, then next time you run, like you say git pull and it pulls down, and then you say whatever npm start, it'll say like npm should be like, oh dude, you don't have the right thing, like you don't have the right one. I know, I don't, you know, npm is a little weird because you usually use like gulp something or like React or some sort of server like tool to like start spinning up a dev environment or whatever. But bundler for the Ruby side of things will actually pretty much complain. It'll say like, you don't have the right ones.
Yeah, totally. It happens to me all the time. I try to spin up our server and it's just like, nah, you can't yet until you bundler, you know,
bundle install. And so yeah, you have to update every, you know, you have to kind of just,
ours is even smart enough to know if you is if the yarn stuff is out too. I don't know how we set that up, but it's like, it won't turn on the server if your yarn stuff is out of date.
See, I wonder if that's because I know Yehuda Katz was consulted on the yarn stuff and he did a lot of the bundler stuff. So I think they're what is siblings, we'll call them. But, you know, there's cool things. I don't know if you've used these commands, bundle outdated and npm outdated in your repo. Nice. It'll tell you which ones like are behind, like it'll nice. Tell you like how. Older.
That's a good command because for a while I was even using a service that would send me an email when a package updated, so I would know, because if it was a major one, it'd be good to know. And that was important, not just for, it was important on the CodePen side because we offer these preprocessors and I just want to know when they have significant releases so we know, you know, and I don't know how to know that otherwise unless use some kind of thing to tell you. I don't feel like setting up a calendar alert that says go check the websites for these 15 projects, and you know, that's no good.
Yeah, what was that? It was like Green Evergreen or Green Machine or something. I forget
which one we used. It was purple.
Okay.
Emails looked purple. That purple has nothing to do with the name. I just remember the marketing color. Oh, whatever.
But something like SNYK, SNYK.
That's for checking for dangers and stuff.
Yeah, that's like a security thing. But one thing they do is they look at your dependencies and kind of see if there were security updates in those dependencies. So that might even be like in the interim way of like, how do I only update when necessary? You know what I mean? Because a lot of these micro updates, you know, I'm looking here and it's like, oh, dude, you're using Jekyll 3.7.0 and the newest one is 3.7.3. And I'm going to be honest with you. I do not care what happened in those 0.3 releases. So I'm probably not going to update or redo the bundle install and risk breaking everything right now. But, you know, if SNYK emailed me or whatever, or whoever emailed me, it's like, hey, there was a security update in Jekyll 3.7.2 that you need to have, I would say like, okay, I'll risk breaking the build for a security update. But again, who knows? I bet there's somebody in some company who runs like bundle update every day or whatever, or like npm update star or whatever, just every day, just updates everything always just to see what happens.
Oh, that makes me so nervous.
Worst person in the office.
But I don't know how you'd know anyway. Like, I guess that's why we have tests, right? Is that you do that and then you run your test suite and you make sure it's all okay.
Yeah, I had a thing where we were not committing a lock file because I was on Windows and people were on Mac. And when you do like Windows and Mac, like you get like Windows, this was for a Ruby project. Windows does like has its own weird logic inside of a lock file. So it was a little bit like, I guess, weird, you know, or incompatible. And so when we'd push to, when I would push from my Windows machine up to Heroku, Heroku's like, okay, I don't understand the Windows thing, gem file. So I'm just going to write my own. So we had a situation where like production broke and I could not replicate it locally because they installed just a brand new gem, a new version of like Nokogiri or something on production than I had locally. And it was kind of like shocking just because I was like, oh, there is like problems here. So that's all been fixed with Bash on Windows. But yeah, it's like it's a weird deal sometimes, you know, lock files.
Right. Doc files. They need to exist. Thank gosh.
Hey, I'd like to welcome a brand new sponsor here on Chop Talk Show, the widely beloved DigitalOcean. I just learned that they have the coolest redirect mini URL, DO, like DigitalOcean, DO.co. The URL that matters to you is do.co/shoptalk, because if you go to that, you get $100 of infrastructure credit. Very generous of them. To use at DigitalOcean, it's the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications of any size, removing infrastructure friction, providing predictability so developers and their teams can spend more time building software that customers love. Heck yeah! There's so many tutorials on DigitalOcean to tell you what you need to do the things that you need to do. It's just fantastic. So it's all about deployment and scaling and making that easy. And you get $100 if you go to do.co/shoptalk. Thanks so much for the sponsorship, DigitalOcean. That's fantastic.
Next question, Ty Hop writes in, I just discovered service workers and Google's concept of the progressive web application, taken together with React Native, another so-called native app killer. Both of these concepts are built on traditional web technologies, HTML, CSS, JS, JSX being derivative. If you were to start your own career over today, would you bet on web-based technologies or native-based technologies like Android or iOS?
If you were to start my career over today, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I'd make any different choices. I mean, oh my God, that's impossible. You know, like, I just like the web. I think that being on the web means you're automatically on Android and iOS also, because websites.
Yeah.
If you're looking into progressive web apps and things that make more native-like feeling anyway, then you're proving that point.
Yeah, I don't know what would change. I do think I could have should switch to an iOS developer 8 years ago, and then I'd be rich right now. But
do you think so?
I don't know. But I like the web. I just, everything about the web I like, and having done the whole native deployment thing, where you go through the App Store and code sign a thing to do this, and then you're provisioned for two weeks until Apple's okay, it's good enough to be on our store. That sucks. So I don't want to do that. That is the worst thing. And even on side projects and stuff, I think about game development and all that. Like that's something I'm getting into. I think about that idea of oh, if I want to deploy this on game I made, I would have to go through the App Store. You know what? I'm just going to download for free, and people can sideload that application, because I don't want to do the App Store stuff. App Stores sound awful. So that would be my only, that would be honestly my biggest hurdle to being a native developer today. I just wouldn't want to do the app stuff, the App Store provisioning and all that stuff. I got some breaking news. Beep, 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 beep. Progressive web apps now in Windows 10. Rolled out a progressive web app and you have a manifest file, Bing bot is crawling the web looking for progressive web apps, and it will suck that into the Windows 10 App Store. So my app Day Trip, which is Austin only, but it's a website, and it's been sucked up into the native web. It's been sucked up into the Windows 10 App Store. And so I can click a button, and I did, and install it on my computer. And I did nothing. I didn't roll that feature out. It just got sucked up into an App Store. That's awesome. Chrome OS doing the same thing. They're sucking up progressive web apps into their App Store. The Safari 11.3 or iOS 11.3 came out, has service workers. So now when you add to home screen, it's running the service worker.
There even some UI that was you visited this website 3 times and we noticed that it's ready for installation. Would you like to add it to your home screen? So not, you don't have to, it even prompts you to do that.
Yeah, that's kind of part on the that's like in Google's side of things. I don't know if Safari has rolled out those heuristics yet. But yeah, that's like the thing too, is like, oh, you visit this website a lot. Why not be install it to your home screen? You might like it there. It's kind of like, it's basically bookmarking, but it's like, hey, you come here.
So now you have a native app that can do all the stuff that native apps can do for the most part, I would think. But you've built it for the web. So you kind of get a freebie in that it works the same way on Android and Windows as well, because it's a website. So you get those for free, which is a hugely, hugely big deal. You haven't rewritten your app 3-4 times. And it's on the web, so it has things like discoverability, which is a big deal. People can Google it and find it, and it has SEO value and discoverability and all that stuff. That's a clear winner. Win, win, win.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just seems like for me and my buck as like a developer at a small shop, progressive web apps are the only way to be cross-platform. You know, that's my only option, really. I mean, I can get a bunch of venture capital to make an iOS app that looks exactly like the website. So, but like, what did I just do? That was a lot of work and a lot of money just to do that. And you know, you make a progressive web app. Guess what? That can be server-side rendered. That can be, he mentioned React Native or, you know, like you can make it a client-side JavaScript app, or it can be a server-side app. It's a website. It just is a website that works in an app shell, like in a container that, you know, calls itself an app. So, yeah. I think we talked about Electron the other day, 2-4 episodes ago. Talked about Electron. Some people like gave some feedback. There is some like stuff in Electron that, you know, comes bundled with a Node environment. So that's, you know, kind of like something a progressive web app doesn't have. It has access to native APIs, which is something a progressive web app maybe doesn't have. I say maybe just because a lot of the native things are available, but things like a file system and stuff like that are going to be a little tough on the web. So anyway, for me, the future is very bright with progressive web apps. Not even in a competitive sense, but in a, you just write a few hundred lines of code and your website is so much better and has so much power. So I think it's, is very mimics native code very amazingly. So one little anecdote, on the Windows Store, day trip on the Windows Store, it says like in like size, like file size, like install size. And it's like 0.5 megabytes or something.
Nice.
And I'm just like, heck yeah. It might even be like 0.5 kilobytes. It's really not much. So, but it's like 0.5 megabytes. And like, think about that. I don't know. Just in, like if you're on a app store or something, or you're on a phone, because it'll install to Windows phones. Not that anyone's using those, but like, you know, like 0.5 megabytes for this app, or I have to like install everything.
Yeah, that's great. It's really wild sometimes when you see a, like the Airbnb app needs to be updated 750 megabytes or whatever. I don't know what's going on there. Like that's not accurate. Like it's not Airbnb. I just made that up just because I happen to have that app on my phone. But and maybe they're not an offender, so don't read too much into that. But we've all seen it, right? Facebook app needs to update something, and you're like, why is it that big?
Facebook, which renders a bunch of web views, why is it 173 megabytes? Like, please to explain to me. Like, I know a lot about computers, and I do not know why that's 173 megabytes. So,
and it's exasperation, but what I want there is truly an explanation, not for it to be fixed. Although, you know, the smaller the better, that would be great. But literally, somebody explain to me what is it? Is it super high res graphics? Is it what is it? Just tell me.
What is it? Yeah. Tell me your kilobytes. Tell me your secrets application. All right. Last question. Should we get into it?
Sure. Sam Dodd, I really liked your episode with Mandy Michael and Laura Schenk about the value of HTML and CSS. It, along with other subjects on the show, has got me thinking about the importance of depth of knowledge or breadth of knowledge? Do you guys think it's important to get a solid, deep understanding of core CSS, vanilla JavaScript before branching out into more advanced topics like CSS Grid, JS frameworks? Would you recommend getting a workable knowledge of each branching out into topics? It's the, you know, every time I get uncomfortable about the learning path. Like, what is the correct learning path? Because everybody in this entire industry had a weavy, windy path to where they are now. So, Sam, your path, like it or not, will be weavy and windy no matter how you cut it. So trying to, like, figure out exactly what the thing to learn is next is whatever. This brings up the Shop Talk Show mantra that we've had for a dang many years on this show, which is please just do some work. Just build websites. And the path will, that will be your path. So to, I feel uncomfortable saying, like, heck yeah, you better learn that dang old semantic CSS and semantic HTML and raw JavaScript before you move on to anything at all more complicated than that.
I do declare. Why would you learn?
That's bullshit. Sorry. People learn abstractions all the time before they move back into this. Learn whatever the heck it is you want to learn. I did see an article that I treated from CSS Tricks yesterday about somebody who kind of took a crack at what the modern learning path is, that I thought did a pretty good job with it of kind of leveling up to more and more and more abstract things. The path was, of course, it did make me uncomfortable. It's a little bit too clean, you know, like what's at the way top and what's at the way bottom. But it felt like a good crack at kind of what this is like in 2018. So I'll have to throw that in the show notes as well. But, you know, I like the stuff about depth versus breadth of knowledge in a way. I have always enjoyed the concept of the T-shaped person or whatever, that's pretty transferable, which means that, yes, you have a breadth of knowledge. It doesn't mean that you're super deep in all of the stuff that you know, but you have a wide awareness of the industry and job in which that you work, and that you have one thing that you're particularly great at. I think that makes you a pretty cool person to work with. They'd be like, oh, they're really knowledgeable about that thing and are broadly knowledgeable, if less so, about lots of things. I don't know. T-shaped sounds good to me.
Yeah. Was that a Mark Otto post or something? Like something tease. I can't find it. It doesn't Google either. Anyway. I really like that post. I'll have to find it. It's sort of that, like, again, generalist versus specialist, you know, mm-hmm. I'm sure there are specialists out there who are, you know, really good at, you know, React 16.3.2 or whatever, you know, but like, you know, or you can be a generalist and you kind of do a little bit of everything, you know, there is, like, I think you'll battle this throughout your career always, you know, like, oh, if I was just a little bit more of a generalist, I'd understand CSS a bit more, or if I was a specialist, I'd be raking in the big React bucks right now, you know. I think that's, like, always kind of a question. I was inspired by the Amy Knight episode of Shop Talk Show a couple weeks ago. I liked Amy's tale, like, starting, like, professional figure skater, awesome. Then, like, switched over to code, right? Went to, like, code school, started out in CSS and felt pretty insecure, I guess, about JavaScript. Switched over to JavaScript, went, like, big time Angular, React, Vue apps, like, doing all that, and kind of felt like she didn't understand CSS anymore. And then she went over to and kind of went deep dive into CSS, and now she's kind of teaching people about how CSS works. I just, that's cool to me. You know what I mean? Like that, I think, yeah, describes the path of people. Like you look up after, like, 2 years of work and you're like, dude, I don't know JavaScript. You know, I think that's, like, very common. Or you look up after, like, 2 years of working and you're like, what's serverless? Why are people talking about this? You know, stuff like that. And then you just kind of, you take out your list of shame, you add another bullet point to it, and you're like, things I gotta learn, serverless. All right, let's get, I'll do that later. So Yeah, it's just that thing. Like, I think we're always, you know, as technology advances, you're always behind. You know what I mean? So hopefully that's not discouraging. You're going to find a foothold where you can do the things you want to do or learn, you know, kind of learn the things you want to learn. I mean, this episode alone, we talked about like WebAssembly and a little bit about Houdini and stuff like that. Like, oh man, that's going to be stuff I have to learn. Like, oh man, like, okay. Should I specialize in that? I'll probably have to do like a little bit of a deep dive and learn that. That said, I'm a very much a generalist, probably in like a lot of things. I don't really have any specializations. That hasn't really hurt me exactly, but maybe I don't know what I'm missing out, you know? I'm a fan of being a generalist just in most things, but that's mm-hmm. probably, I think it's different people, different strokes, you know? So some people really like to be really good at one thing and they like to excel at a thing. And so maybe that's you. So,
I like it. That could be you.
One thing I would recommend, even this is me. I know a lot about JavaScript. I write JavaScript, vanilla JavaScript all the time. But I just was like, you know, I'm going to take Wes Boss's ES6, 7, 8 course or whatever it's called now. And I just sat through those and I watched them all just to like feel like, okay, I have caught up to the conversation. And that was a big thing too. Like it was more just kind of making sure I'd like covered bases. I don't know how that fits into Sam's question exactly, but it's kind of just this idea of maybe you don't need to focus. Maybe you just need to catch up on the conversation. Does that make sense? Like, so that's what I was going to say.
I love it, Dave.
Let's wrap up. This has been another episode of Shop Talk Show. Thank you for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. We really appreciate it. If you want to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. If you listened to our last episode but forgot to do it, please send us feedback. Kind of want to know like when you jumped on the show and kind of what you think about it. What do you like? What do you dislike? Let us know these things because we'd like to we're not selling data to advertisers. We really just need to know like how's Shop Talk for you. That's kind of what, you know, and then when'd you kind of start in on this journey? So we'd love to know that stuff. So hit us up on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. We really appreciate it. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.